Hi, welcome to another edition of the PCRF podcast. My name is Dave Page, and I'm a paramedic instructor at Inver Hills Community College, and I'm here with
Marshall Washick, paramedic with Health East Medical Transportation in St. Paul.
Dr. Keith Wesley, I'm the medical director at Health East Medical Transportation in St. Paul.
And Josh Salzman, director of critical care research at Regents Hospital in St. Paul.
So we're going to review a couple of cardiology articles here, papers that all deal with identification of ST elevation MI. And we'll start with the American Journal of Emergency Medicine, 2011, volume 29. This is from Dr. Werman and company on transmission of 12-lead electrocardiographic tracings by emergency medical technician basics and emergency medical technician intermediates, a feasibility study. So this was printed recently here, 2011, and the study essentially, we don't really want to spend too much time on it. It shows that, in fact, you can have EMT basics in a rural area, obtain a 12-lead, transmit it, and that by doing so, you will decrease the time to door-to-balloon time, and this can be reliably achieved. So I think on 95.5% of these 89 patients that were studied. Again, we're not going to spend a lot of time on this because I think our reaction to this was a great paper to have again. We applaud the researchers. If I speak for everybody here, we're constantly pleased to see EMS-related research. And we're struggling to understand, I guess I'm struggling to understand how this is news. I still wanted to put it out there because sometimes we get lost in our own perspectives and maybe it isn't such big news and the rest of the country does need to hear that an EMT basic can get a 12-lead EKG. They didn't get educated as to how to read them, and so that is definitely not the point of this. It's just whether or not the obtainment of the 12-lead is possible. And one more example of how a fairly simple research project can be put together and printed and published in a respectable journal, and in fact helps our profession, moves us forward in that it's possible. So why aren't more EMTs doing it is a different question, but at the moment we know it's possible. Here's another paper that tells us it's possible.
Well, I think this paper brings out a couple of important issues. One, the reason why this study was done, I spoke with Dr. Carol Cunningham, the state medical director for Ohio, and they were examining the possibility of expanding the scope of practice for the EMT basic to acquire 12 leads. Now, we're pretty blessed here in Minnesota and Wisconsin and in our portion of the Midwest, where that's been a part of the scope of practice for a number of years. Our challenge continues to be how to transmit it, and we can address that in a second. But the state of Ohio said, all right, we need to do a pilot study. Can we train them how to do it? Because if we can and it's feasible, then we can validate expanding the scope of practice, not just anecdotally based upon a feel good, let's do it, but actually on some empiric evidence. And these authors, not only did they just say, okay, can we train these EMTs to do it and then do some kind of skill station and to prove it, they actually had them perform it on over 100 patients with suspected acute coronary syndromes and gauged the quality of the EKG. And the only things they found is V4 tended to be a fairly commonly misplaced lead. Well, join the ranks of the paramedics, you EMTs, because paramedics have a problem figuring out where V4 goes. I know I'm going to get cards and letters on that one. Just send them to Marshall Washing. But what they further found out was, which I thought was it was understated in the study, was that they found that the best, this was in a rural setting, that the best feasibility for transmission was the use of satellite phones.
Yeah, I found that interesting as well, because I do think the challenge isn't the collection, it's the transmission. and reliable cell coverage in the middle of nowhere is the problem. So, you know, is it time to put sat phones on all the BLS units? And is that...
I think so. And I think what a perfect reason to use federal FEMA disaster preparedness money. Double duty. The best way for EMS to be prepared for natural disasters is communications. We know that that's the number one issue that arises in natural and man-made disasters. And so to have a piece of equipment that's relatively expensive, I think they're still around 10 grand for a fairly reliable, plus one that has the connections with your machine to be able to transmit. But instead of having it locked away in a box to be used once in a blue moon for the natural disaster, have something that's being used on a daily basis and resulting in direct patient benefit.
I love it. Well, this dovetails well with a different paper that also had to do with ST Elevation MI and pre-hospital providers. From the American Journal of Emergency Medicine, 2011, volume 29 here. This is pre-hospital delay and its impact on time to treatment in ST elevation myocardial infarction. So Dr. Chugtai, I hope I'm pronouncing that well, my apologies if I'm not, and company out of New Jersey, looked at the time intervals. And this is a study that assessed the impact of pre-hospital time and with patient outcome, which I really applaud this group for looking at time intervals a little bit differently than normal. The traditional time intervals in ST elevation, I think we'd all agree, have been about the door to balloon time most of the time. And very little has been done with, some on time of onset of symptoms and then time to 911 call. But this was really a time interval study that looked at all of it, including how long the response time was or the transport time and whether all of that total pre-hospital time. So if you add up from the moment of dialing 911 to the moment the patient hits that door in the emergency department, whether or not that really affected the outcome of these STEMI patients. And I also want to applaud the Newark area, I guess, where this was done, in that the EMS providers here appear to have quite short scene times for patients who are experiencing an ST elevation MI. And so when you look at the data here, one of the conclusions from the study was that by minimizing scene time, outcomes could be improved. I think we'll have an opportunity to discuss this a little bit further, but I think we could probably take aim at some other systems where pre-hospital scene times are a lot longer than what these were. So, and I'm going to find you the exact number of minutes here, because I believe that it's under 20 most of the time, and they were doing a really pretty good job with that. Door to balloon time and time to actually reperfuse continues to be measured in 90-minute intervals, not in 5, 10, or 15, or 20-minute intervals. So, and as far as the EMS system is concerned, taking aim at the very short window seems to me like a concern from this paper. But nevertheless, it's valuable. I'm glad they did this research, because it shows once again the value of an EMS system that does identify the STEMI and that outcomes are linked to the speed at which we get arteries reperfused. What do you guys think?
It's a silence, so I'm going to jump in.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
So I think that this is also a paper that it's important from a methodology standpoint to recognize its limitations, primarily in some of the overstatements that were made, from my opinion, in the conclusion section. about the association between treatment time of more than 120 minutes and increased adverse cardiovascular outcomes. I know sometimes semantics become irritating for people to think about, but when you are evaluating a research protocol and a design and analysis that uses the word associated, it has a pretty strong connotation that there's some really significant link between the two factors that you're talking about.
I.e. cause and effect.
Right. Mm-hmm. So I think just a caution to the readers as you go out and review this paper that when they talk about an association between adverse events, we are really only looking at a total of 11 events happening, two of which are in one group and nine are in the other. And when you look at the way they break them down, the death piece is the one that I think is probably the most eye-opening, but also to keep in perspective that's a really difficult association to make with only four patients, even if all of them were in one group. So the other part that I think is important is there was a lack of delineation in the treatment groups in terms of the number of patients in each of those. They say there are 60 total within their subject population, but they don't break it down to the number of patients that were in the greater than 120 and those that were less. And I think my final comment would be that this study is using data from 2006, and I think in the last 5 years, with the amount of emphasis that has likely been placed on STEMI and early recognition and treatment and care and transport, that I don't know that there's a whole lot that a reader with 60, knowing that you're talking about 60 patients, is going to gain other than this was just a description of what their system looks like. It wasn't a comparison between, a true comparison between groups. So I have a few caveats with that, with those methodology issues, but, you know, on balance, I think, again, it's always important to bring recognition to what EMS providers can do to improve patient care in general and STEMI care specifically.
I couldn't agree with you more, Josh. I'm a little concerned by the authors. Part of their agenda for the article, I believe, is stated in their conclusion, and that is that to consider that we should start the clock, the reperfusion clock, at the time of 911 call. And I'm saying, oh, all right. So we're going to have one clock for pre-hospital patients and a different clock for patients who walk into the triage. Well, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. And so maybe then the true time to start the hospital clock is the time that the patient's the onset of symptoms, or the time that they got in their car and began driving to the hospital. So, you know, when to start the clock is certainly an interesting question. And they make the association that when the scene time or the pre-hospital time and the door-to-balloon time resulted in a total treatment time exceeding 120 minutes, that mortality was higher. Again, I agree with you. The outcome measures they use are not consistent with the generally accepted outcome measures that we look at for reperfusion adverse events. They didn't talk about TEMI flow rates, reperfusion rates. They didn't tell us what percentage of the patients outside the 120 minutes got PCI or got lytics. So there's a lot of other outcome information not told to us about the patients. And the bottom line problem with the methodology is this a system with pre-hospital notification and cath lab activation or not? Did all these patients, regardless of their pre-hospital time, still wind up stopping in the ER to be further evaluated, which in my mind restarts the door to device time? So we know that there's data out there that pre-hospital notification by EMS and specifically cath lab activation by EMS results in quicker perfusion times. So I take that away from the study that says, I'm going to make the assumption, unless the authors correct me, I'm going to assume that this is a system without pre-hospital notification. And this is a system where they maybe they notify the ER, but they still stop in the ER for confirmation before they go to the cath lab. Well, we know that that results in significant delays in cath lab arrival. And that, if anything, if you have a system like that, and your numbers are similar to this with a scene time, and these are scene times of 19 minutes,
yeah, mean, 18 minutes plus 17.8, or minus. I mean, yeah, that's pretty good.
18 minutes plus or minus 9 minutes. Well, that means then that at the far end of the spectrum, that's 27 minutes. Well, 27 minutes scene time far exceeds the average scene time, quote unquote, of the patient in the ER.
Great points. You know, I really love the concept of sort of identifying all these pieces and putting this paper together with a paper we just looked at on EMTs and whether or not our cities are better served with or without paramedics, and is BLS better than ALS. And obviously we have, each of us may have biases. I know I have a bias, but you have to wonder, are more ambulances carrying around 12 lead EKG machines going to make that big of an impact when, you know, sure, you could have less response times. They might be more quicker on scene because they're not doing as many interventions. So all they have to do is throw on that 12 lead, you're having chest pain, let's take you to the cath lab. And if it's just all about getting the EKG and transmitting it, then one would have to say maybe we should have more BLS ambulances with 12 leads and forget these ALS units that have 18 minute scene times. What was interesting about the first paper is that it didn't extend scene times at all. That the 12 lead is not the factor extending scene times. And I found it fascinating to compare a rural scene time to an urban scene time and figure out that, in fact, they're not that different. I think anybody who is going to do this kind of research really needs to analyze the time involved in moving someone from inside a bedroom, inside their home, upstairs, downstairs, in a basement, in a restaurant, and the logistics involved with actually getting a human body into the back of an ambulance. Because, you know, whether it's 3 minutes or 5 minutes or 7 minutes, that clock gets eaten up very quickly when you're saying, sir, we don't want to walk you down the steps. We don't want to, you know, we got to go get the stretcher, got to go get the stair chair. We don't want to cause your heart to work any harder. So suddenly, I think 18 minutes is pretty good when you have to build in the time to move people if you're not going to make them walk.
Well, that's absolutely correct. And if you look at table one that showed their demographics of the patients, they have on average higher older age group than the average MI that walks into the ER. That the average age is more in the mid 50s, and this was 63. So this is a significantly different population that EMS deals with. With suspected acute coronary syndromes than those that tend to be younger, healthier, more mobile, and able to come to the ER. And so I think you have to be very, very careful trying to make any type of an association between the impact of pre-hospital time on mortality.
I love one of the takeaway messages that I think I'm hearing from this is that the longer the patient is in your care, the more you need to be worried about the chances that this patient may arrest. And so whether you control some of the variables or not, I think the take-home message is something we've already heard before. We know that STEMI patients go into VFib on a fairly regular basis, and maybe we should be a little more proactive about putting pads on those patients on the off chance that they will arrest. And if we've identified that there's a STEMI and we have a longer transport time, start thinking about, you know, the fact that this could go south really quick and not be caught with our pants down, so to speak.
I think that and the subject that I would challenge these authors to take the same system if they do not have EMS notification and cath lab activation, to institute that and measure the same outcome measures that they use, good, better, and different. At least it'll be apples to apples, a before and after effect of direct cath lab activation. And I think that what they'll find is, at least what I believe anecdotally, is that what the time spent in pre-hospital, if you have cath lab activation, more than offsets the savings made in delivery to the cath lab and reperfusion time. Because I still believe that when you look at the Boyd in JAMA just this week produced a paper on door in, door out time, and that is, if you're a non-PCI hospital and cannot get the patient out of the hospital to a primary PCI center in less than 30 minutes, and that's 30 minutes from the time they walk up to triage, that their mortality is significantly higher, because they are more likely not to get PCI because they wind up getting to the primary tertiary facility outside the window, and that possibly in those situations they ought to be getting lytics instead. Well, in their study, only 11% of the hospitals, or 11% of the patients in the hospitals they study, were able to achieve that 30-minute standard. Well, that's okay. When only 11% of hospital patients can hit the 30 minutes, and we're going to start gigging EMS on a pre-hospital time of 45, give me a break.
So I got a quick question, Dave, because I'm really kind of hung up on this whole time thing and treatment. Because, you know, when you pointed to the, you know, these relatively short scene times, and moving a patient, I mean, if you look at the averages, the average scene time is 18 minutes, and departure to door time, or the time that they leave and get to the hospital, is 11. And so it's an average of 27 minutes. To me, that just seems really, really fast, and that they're not doing anything other than, like you said, maybe a 12 lead.
Oh, I don't know if you can say that.
Well, I'm just saying, I'm trying to think of everything that I would do for a STEMI patient.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, two IVs, oxygen, aspirin, maybe a nitro drip, maybe a little bit of morphine, maybe some Zofran because they might be nauseated. I have a tough time conceptualizing that and thinking that I can get all that done in 27 minutes.
Marshall, you're making a lot of assumptions that aren't spelled out in this paper. These authors don't tell us whether or not they're EMS. They didn't even tell us they were paramedics, did they?
No, they didn't.
This could have been an EMT basic service that did that just basically load and goad.
Well, but we don't know. But I'm just saying, though.
I agree with you, but it begs the incredulous. When I look at our scene times for our STEMI patients, I would love to have an average scene time of 18 minutes when I know that our average scene time is
and
closer
I
to
don't
27.
Really, I mean, look at, 10-minute trauma scene times with two large bore IVs being done en route to the hospital. Giving some aspirin and some nitro on top of that, I don't know that that's not entirely not only possible, but once you get a pit crew mentality, these crews are doing a fantastic job. So maybe we need to, I don't know, speed you up a little bit.
Or give you more help so you're not the only one doing it.
There you go.
Well, yeah, maybe the average crew. This was, you know, there was like four or five guys on the crew.
Yeah, I think, overall, as I read through this, it was really hard for me to put a lot of stock even in just the way that there are details that are almost key, that are just missing out of this. So it's hard to make any real conclusions from my perspective.
And once again, we want to applaud the researchers because the point of these podcasts is that we love to see researchers asking questions about EMS. And the point being that for you budding researchers out there, you too can do this. No research project is perfect, and everyone can poke holes at these things. So it's fun to do, but we really, really appreciate those folks that are doing it. Good job.